In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Everytown Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. We give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown Podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
She would wake up in the middle of the night and hear this music. And at first she thought maybe she'd left the TV on or something like that. But she would go out to check, and the music would stop as soon as she got into the room where this violin case was hanging on the wall.
Hey there, I'm hard at work on another edition of Inner Sanctum, my free monthly newsletter. Inner Sanctum features my monthly brief, a column of my thoughts and opinions on what's happening in the world. It features a spotlight on a past guest, a look ahead to an upcoming episode of my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. It features a look at this month in conspiracy and UFO history, and my Conspiracy Unlimited podcast episode pick of the month, and so much more. To get your free monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, delivered to your email inbox, just go to my website, strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. Scroll down to the bottom of the page and click on Inner Sanctum and register. It's fast, easy, and again, absolutely free.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption. And the secret machinations of powerful elites. revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
It's that time of the month, and it's time for a visit from our paranormal investigator extraordinaire, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Now, of late, Rosemary joins me in the latter half of the show, and we get her take on some paranormal stories in the news. We call it our Paranormal News Roundup. But tonight, we've got a special treat for you, because Rosemary is with us for the entire hour. She has a brand new book out. It's called Haunted by the Things You Love, which she's a co-author with John Zaffis. Zaffis, you may remember, is a paranormal researcher of some renown, and he has a paranormal reality TV show called The Haunted Collector. I believe it's on Sci-Fi. He's not with us tonight, but we do have, of course, Rosemary, and she's no stranger to this topic. We've talked about haunted objects before, but we're delighted to have the whole hour to do so. Again, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, one of the leading experts on the paranormal, with more than 50 books published by major houses on a wide range of paranormal, spiritual, mystical topics, including 9 single-volume encyclopedias, last time I checked anyway. Her work is translated into 15 languages, and she's worked full-time in the paranormal since 1983, researching, investigating, writing, and presenting, and, of course, teaching. Always a pleasure to welcome back Rosemary Ellen Guiley. How are you, Rosemary?
Wow, Richard, it's been quite a weekend. John and I were at a major paranormal conference in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, where we actually debuted our new book, Haunted by the Things You Love, that we'll be talking about this evening. We were both presenting at the conference, and the actual debut in hard print and an ebook was on Friday, and it's gotten off to a terrific start, very well received. John has many, many fans from his long career in the paranormal, and also as the star of his own reality show, Haunted Collector, which was all about objects that have spirit attachments and then create havoc with people who acquire them.
Yes, congratulations, first of all, on the book. And what is this for you, number 51, 52, 53? I've lost count, Rosemary.
I'm pushing 60 now,
oh, my.
I think.
Now, is John's program still available on Sci-Fi, The Haunted Collector?
It's being shown in reruns. At the end of season 3, John decided that he wanted to do some other things, pursue some other projects, and he felt that the show had had a very good run. It was one of the top paranormal reality shows on air, and especially on Sci-Fi. And so they're no longer in production, but it still cycles around. And, of course, John's still very active, as I am, doing appearances on media and at events. He's had a very long career in demonology. He's related by blood to the late Ed Warren, who was quite famous with his wife, Lorraine Warren, who's still out and about doing audiences and events, you know, demonic hauntings. And that's really where John got his start with haunted objects, is that some of the cases he worked on very early in his career involved objects that had spirit attachments and were the source of trouble. And then, of course, in my own career, I've come across that too in my investigations. People go out, they get things secondhand. They don't realize that what they're bringing into the home has something extra attached to it. And then people like myself and John get called when all kinds of activity breaks out in a place, and people start having lots of problems, and they can't pinpoint it to anything. So it winds up being these objects. John has collected literally hundreds, probably actually thousands, if you count the things that he's got stored away in boxes. He has a building on his property, a little barn that he calls the John Zaffis Museum of the Paranormal, where he has hundreds of these objects on display.
Have they been exercised?
They have been, yes. When What happens when we get a case is when we get it identified as object-related, usually the people don't want anything to do with it. They're more than happy to get rid of it. Sometimes they'll even say, please, please, take this thing away. And so then John takes the objects and he neutralizes them, which consists of, a number of different things. One is that a spirit could be detached from an object and sent away. And another is that it's literally bound to the object through prayers and the use of things like sea salt, which has a lot of the same properties that, you know, blessed salt would have. And when they're placed in the museum, then, they're inactive. Some of the objects that have very strong spirits attached to them, he will put in a like a glass display case or an acrylic case, because even handling them or bumping into them could jar some activity loose. But in spite of all of that, when you go around and look at all these objects, and I've spent a lot of time in the museum examining things and talking with John about the specifics of individual cases, there's still phenomena that happen.
Even once they've been exorcised? Even once the spirit's been bound to the object or they've been exorcised?
Well, sometimes the things that have been bound, they do get loose a bit. And so people will sometimes see things, or they'll hear voices or feel kind of creepy presences. I have gotten EVP there. There was one of the days that we were doing research for the book. We were walking around the museum, and I just had a digital recorder with me for note-taking purposes. And when I went back to transcribe the tape, at the very end of it, there was a masculine-sounding voice that whispered, "John," just like that,
oh,
right at the
my.
End.
Oh, my. That would chill you to the bone. And probably
so,
not you.
You know,
you're used to that.
Things are still there.
Well, what's fascinating to me is that there are so many phenomena associated with one single inanimate object. You know, as you say, you bring in, let's say you buy a bonnet chest at a flea market. You bring it home, and then a short while later, you've got, maybe it's a string of bad luck. Maybe you're seeing poltergeist disturbances. Maybe you're having, you know, weird dreams, nightmares. You're seeing shadow people. I mean, can one object cause all of these things, or is it usually just one?
Usually there's one spirit attached to an object. And actually, there are a number of explanations for attachments. And one, the most active is spirit. A spirit, for example, let's say an individual has a spirit attachment, and when that person dies, the spirit stays with one of their possessions, and it's sort of an emotional bonding sort of thing. Sometimes people will inadvertently call in spirits. They're involved in mediumship, or they're experimenting with summoning or spirit communications, and they'll call in things, and then those things linger in the environment. They don't go away, and they will attach to objects that, sort of like a snail has a house, you know, and it's a place to live. Sometimes objects are afflicted with curses. We've got several cases in the book, usually involving love relationships gone bad, where people have deliberately cursed something and then given it as a gift, and it's like a peace offering or a present of some sort, and then that spirit comes in like a Trojan horse to wreak havoc in a place. Then there's thought form energy and residual energy from a person, just intense emotions that sort of create an animated thought form energy that can boomerang around. So most of these things do happen with secondhand objects that you find in estate sales and antique shops, but even new objects can become afflicted as well.
Rosemary, early in my career, when I was producing talk radio, we received this email. I guess it would have been a fax back then, actually. This couple, they were in Cambridge, Ontario, and they had come into possession of a beautiful hand-carved bench. which they later named the Devil's Bench. And it had the image of the, I think it's the Roman god Bacchus. Is that the Greek god or a Roman god, the god of wine? But it looked sort of devilish. And as soon as they got this bench into their home, the husband lost his job, the wife got sick, and just one string of, you know, misfortune after another. So they got so desperate, they contacted us and wanted to know if we could help them have this thing exercised. So we actually brought it into the studio. And this is going back almost 20 years, you know, before I was a believer in the spirit world and the unseen world and so forth. And so I was sort of flaunting. It was in my office overnight, and then in the morning I was sitting on it and saying, this isn't going to, you know, there's no problem with this bench. Luckily nothing happened, but I was playing with fire. We did have it exercised on the air, and then we actually auctioned it off. That was my first sort of experience with haunted objects. But I want to talk to you about these, because one of the most common objects that are haunted, and we've talked about this recently, there was an item in the news, haunted dolls. One can understand why a spirit would have an attachment to a childhood doll. But give us some for instances from the book, people that have contacted you with haunted or possessed dolls.
Clown dolls rank at the top of the list. And the dolls in general are probably the leading candidates for afflicted objects. They're substitutes for people. They're made like people. Sometimes they're animated electronically, and we give them personalities. You know, kids play with them. Adults like to collect them. They have personalities, and so many spirits find this very appealing to take over a doll and then start acting out. And some of these stories actually get to be Twilight Zone kind of material, you know, something that you think really belongs in a horror film.
My name is Talking Tina, and I want to kill you. Remember?
One of my favorite Twilight Zone episodes where the doll gets back at a daddy who doesn't like the doll. And we find, we haven't found any fatal dolls yet, but we've certainly found dolls that start talking in their owner's heads. People say, I can hear this voice that I know belongs to the doll, and it's telling me things. The dolls will be found moving around on their own. Now, people don't see the dolls scurrying around, but they'll put the doll, for example, on a shelf in a room, and then they'll leave and then come back later, and the doll isn't there anymore. It's somewhere else in the room. It's on the floor, or it's in another location. And that can be very chilling and unsettling. People will have nightmares. They will hear footsteps in hallways and in their bedrooms. They'll see shadow figures. And as you were just describing, also a breakdown of life. People begin to have health problems. Their relationships often suffer, fighting, bickering. A lot of things that you wouldn't automatically label paranormal, but yet are part of a whole syndrome of things that happen when unpleasant spirit activity takes hold in an environment.
I remember my mother she still has it. It's an antique doll. I don't think she had it from childhood. I think she purchased it because it maybe reminded her of a doll she had. And it had the beautiful blue bonnet and like a felt or a velvet dress. And it had those, you know, the antique dolls have those eyes that open and close and so forth. And she had it sitting on her bed, and this is going back late 90s, and I bought her a dog, and I brought the dog home for her. The dog made a beeline to her bedroom and started barking at this doll, and like every day would go into her room and start barking at this doll. And you know, we know that pets seem to have this sensitivity to, I guess, psychic phenomena or whatever it is. But maybe maybe that doll needs to be exercised.
Sometimes there are attachments that they're not extreme, but yet animals will pick up on them. People might just have an unsettled feeling like, oh, that kind of gives me the creeps and I don't know why. We get those kinds of cases a lot too. And then we have these more extreme cases where there are outbreaks of a very unpleasant activity. And I mentioned clown dolls at the top of the list.
They're the worst.
Many people are frightened of clowns. Clowns really are kind of scary, And they also are very prominent figures in a lot of horror stories. And so of all the dolls, and John has dozens and dozens of dolls in the museum, he's got more clown dolls than any other kind.
Now, just a slight digression here. It relates to fear of clowns. I'm not sure if it was Dr. David Jacobs who told me this, or it might have even been you, that a fear of clowns may actually have at its root some sort of an alien abduction scenario. Have you heard that?
I have. I have not encountered that in any of my own cases, but I have read cases where abductees will, as part of the abduction scenario, they'll see like creepy faces show up in the window that look very clown-like. And certainly some of the monstrous forms that come along in the whole play of phenomena as well with abductions, they can look very grotesque and gargoyle-like or clown-like.
Do we understand or the process of how an object becomes either possessed or haunted?
Sometimes we don't know exactly because we can't trace the whole history of an object, but we can speculate based on what we know about certain kinds of objects. For example, in certain parts of the world, when masks are made for ritual purposes, those things are made specifically to house spirits. Spirits are invited to live in the mask. When people wear them, they undergo a form of temporary possession where that spirit is permitted to speak and act through the human being. It's a very controlled sort of possession because when the ritual is over, the spirit doesn't stay in the person, but it goes to its house in the mask. Well, collectors who travel around the world and want the real deal, not just the commercial masks made for tourists, which are inert, they go out and acquire these things, and they may not realize that they're bringing home the abode of a spirit. And these spirits are often not happy to be taken out of their native land. They'll be usually put on display in another environment, and if the conditions are right, and sometimes it depends on the people involved and their sensitivity to the spirit world, then the spirit can act out in a very unhappy manner, just like an unhappy child even. And people have had nightmares. We've got a story in the book where a woman acquired an African mask that was a genuine ritual mask. And among the things that happened to her were nightmares where she was in this foreign setting. She was out in this foreign land, out in a field of grass, and she was with people who were drumming and chanting. And this dream repeated over and over again. We believe that she was tapping into some sort of ritual memories that had come along with the mask and the spirit.
Does the material from which the object, piece of furniture or a doll or whatever, does the material it's constructed from make any difference? For example, porcelain versus wood, is one a greater conductor of spirit activity?
Well, we find that all kinds of objects can hold spirits, and we've certainly seen the gamut, every kind of material you can imagine. However, metal is at the top of the list for its ability to retain psychic energy, followed by wood, followed by natural stone, like crystal, field stone, and things like that. So, like this tribal mask I was just talking about, of course, it was carved out of wood. And it even had a hair that was attached to it that had been very carefully braided out of hemp. And sometimes bits of bone are attached to these things, shells and other objects that all are also very good retainers. But those would be the top three. However, we've had porcelain statues, clothing even can retain very powerful psychic memories and energy if it's been worn with by someone who's had a great deal of emotional attachment to it. So it's almost anything you can think of has the potential to be haunted. Mirrors are another example. Mirrors have a reputation for being doorways to the spirit world, and some of them seem to have let in some very unusual entities into some of the cases that we've dealt with.
Well, let's talk about possessed mirrors, and give me an example from the book, Haunted by the Things You Love.
One of the most unusual mirror cases that I've ever encountered was this mirror that came in a, it was an ornate mirror in a cherry frame that was very nicely carved, had some age on it, probably early, you know, early to mid-20th century. And a couple bought it at a sale, and they put it in their dining room. Well, the husband was always kind of creeped out by this mirror, but the wife was not affected. We find this in cases, too, where there's a principal focal point. One person in the household gets the brunt of it, even if other people experience something. Well, he would see these shadowy forms go into the mirror. Now, usually in a haunting where a mirror is involved, people will talk about seeing filmy forms and faces in a mirror, and they will see things come out of a mirror. But this is the only case that I have ever heard of where somebody sees things going into a mirror. He never saw them coming out. These dark shadow forms started appearing in his house, and they would react to him seeing them. And as soon as he saw them, they would zip into the dining room, and if he was fast enough, he could catch them disappearing into the mirror. He also started having nightmares. And he called them the blobs and the blobby beings. The blobs were talking to him, and they were telling him that his friends and family were out to get him and they couldn't be trusted. Well, his health deteriorated, his relationship with his wife deteriorated, and she didn't see anything wrong. She thought it was all in his head. Even when they had marked poltergeist phenomena in the house, she was unwilling to consider paranormal explanations. This took a very, even after the situation was resolved and John came and took the mirror out, something had attached to the husband, and the couple ended up splitting up. They'd been having kind of a rocky marriage anyway, and this was like the last straw. They split up, but even after he moved out of the house, he continued to have these disturbing nightmares, along with this feeling, this foreboding that something terrible was going to happen to him. And John heard later on that he had been killed in a tragic auto accident. So we're left to wonder, you know, were these blobby beings, were they part of that? Were they trying to warn him? Or were they part of some sort of tragic paranormal game where he was being given advance warning of his doom?
All right, we'll step away for a few moments, Rosemary. Stay where you are, and we'll reconnoiter on the other side and continue to delve into haunted objects, haunted by the things you love, with co-author Rosemary Ellen Guiley.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries, or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it, and we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
I call it the miracle molecule, carbon 60 or C60 from my good friends at Evo C60. I take a tablespoon every morning. It delivers more than 172 times the power of vitamin C. C60 is a known antiviral, antioxidant, antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, and it's a remedy that works. C60 Evo can slow down the aging process by reducing cellular damage. C60 Evo users consistently enjoy better sleep and wake up feeling refreshed. I sleep like a baby. I have no aches or pains. Zero. I'm 58, and I don't have a gray hair on my head. And I have boundless energy. Get your miracle molecule in a bottle. C60 from c60evo.com/Richard-Serrett. Use the coupon code EVRS at checkout and save 10%. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. If you have a medical concern, please contact your healthcare provider.
Theoretical physicists say that there is as many as 12 hyperdimensions. Here are just three of them. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Pretty cool, huh? Here's an extra one. Conspiracy Unlimited. Hey, how about one more? Conspiracy Unlimited. And the great thing is we have 6 hyperdimensions left. Conspiracy Unlimited. 5.
Welcome back. We are with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She joins us every month at this time, and we are spending the whole hour with her, and happy to do so. She has a brand new book out, co-authored by John Zaffis. It's entitled Haunted by the Things You Love, and we're discussing haunted objects. Coincidentally, today, I believe it's today, is Scott McClellan's birthday. Now, Scott McClellan, here in the Toronto area, is the man behind Carnival Diablo, which is one of the last sort of traveling sideshows in Canada. And he has a ventriloquist a dummy called Waldo that he actually purchased at auction from a U.S. government warehouse. It had been stowed away and had many, many owners. It was actually carved by the same, I don't know, a puppeteer, I guess, that carved Charlie McCarthy. And Waldo, supposedly, is connected with about a dozen mysterious deaths over the years. In one case, the owner's house was leveled by a natural gas explosion and everyone in the house died, and Waldo was left totally intact. And the original owner was a ventriloquist in vaudeville, who was found mysteriously beaten or bludgeoned to death in his dressing room, even though there was no sign of entry and the door was locked from the inside. Waldo, he later learned, he learned this from a psychic who knew nothing of Waldo's past. The psychic simply walked up to the doll and said to Scott, "This dummy was carved from a hangman's tree." And Rosemary Ellen Guiley, I asked you earlier about the material that something is, whether that has anything to do with whether something is haunted. If something is made from a hangman's tree or carved from maybe the wood left over from a coffin or something like that, can that cause something to be haunted or possessed?
It certainly could, and in fact, in all likelihood, it would be. That would be a very bad idea. The wood would be able to retain all of these unhappy emotions, anger, fear, violent death. A hanging is a violent, unpleasant way to die. And all of those psychic energies could be absorbed by the wood, and perhaps dozens and dozens of them, depending upon how many people died there. We have a similar case in the book, a deathbed, a wooden deathbed that came out of Africa, and this is a huge slab of wood on very short legs with a saddle headrest at one end. And it apparently was used for corpses to be laid out on prior to burial or some sort of probably not cremation, although some people told us it was cremation, but probably more likely burial. And it was brought over by tourists and collectors to this country. People started getting sick, chronically sick. Nightmares, again, there's a syndrome of things that happen in almost all of these cases. Nightmares, shadow figures, bad smells, unusual sounds, and then health issues. And it got passed from them to another set of owners who experienced the same thing. And then finally to a young couple who turned it into a coffee table.
Oh, my.
They thought it was cool to have a deathbed as a coffee table. And the girlfriend got horribly afflicted, and she left. It split the couple up. And at that point, then, the man who had acquired it decided that, well, maybe it was time to get rid of it because he was starting to experience things, too. And this is, a piece of wood that we have no idea how many bodies it held, but you can imagine the range of emotions. We don't know how those people died. Some of them might have had lingering, unhappy deaths, or they might have died violently. People coming to view corpses would be in a state of shock, grief, maybe even anger. All of those emotions go into something like that, and it absorbs it like a sponge.
Sometimes we look at an object and it might be innocuous, or in fact it may represent, maybe it's a statuette or something, it may represent something that's quite positive. Let's say, for example, an angel or a cherub. And yet, that cherub may actually be haunted, and there's a case in your book.
That was a deliberate curse. And it's a great example of spurned love. A man and a woman had a relationship. They went out for a while. He was more in love with her than she felt about him. She broke off the relationship, took up with another man, and got married and was very happy. She moved on with her life. The man who was left behind never got over her, kept thinking about her, couldn't understand why she left him. She was the perfect woman for him. He wanted her back. And so he decided to try magic to get her back. And she liked angels and cherubs, and she had artwork of them. And so he drew this picture of this little winged cherub And it's really creepy looking because he gave it coal black eyes. It's got solid black eyes, just like you would think a picture of a demon would have. And he infused it with a magical spell. He taught himself how to do it. He put a spell on the back of the drawing and hid it in the frame, and then called her up and invited her to lunch and said he had a present for her. And she reluctantly went, accepted it. She didn't really like it, didn't want to take a present, but she didn't want to hurt his feelings. And she began to have a lot of problems. She started thinking about her old ex and wearing his jewelry that he had given her. She started fighting with her husband, and it created a lot of problems. It was a deliberate curse.
Musical instruments, Rosemary, can quite easily be haunted. One can imagine, you know, that people become attached in this life and the next, as it turns out.
We have a case where a woman who was a musician, she collected instruments, and she got this antique violin. And it was in a kind of a shadow box, a display that she put up on the wall. And shortly after it came in, her house was cold all the time, and she couldn't figure it out. And her cat just seemed to be kind of creeped out a lot, like there was something in the house. She had nightmares, and then she started hearing phantom violin music. And phantom music is not uncommon in a lot of hauntings, a lot of haunted places, but she would wake up in the middle of the night and hear this music. And at first she thought maybe she'd left the TV on or something like that, but she would go out to check, and the music would stop as soon as she got into the room where this violin case was hanging on the wall. She had dark shadow figures in her room. One night she woke up and there was a shadowy figure in the house, and she thought an intruder had broken in, and she went tearing out. And then it seemed that there was nobody in the house. She kind of went back in and checked around, and the house was empty. No one had broken in. So she started to get more and more on edge and more terrified. And then the music kept going in the middle of the night. And then the breaking point came when this thing flew off the wall at her. It's like invisible hands wrenched it off the wall and hurled it, trying to hit her. Hurled it with great force, but it missed. And when it crashed to the floor, the odd thing was that the case broke, the violin broke, but the case did not. Here we have a display case with glass, and the case itself remained intact, but the violin was broken in two. So we didn't know much about the history of the violin. She didn't either. The shop where she had bought it, they just knew that it was an antique, but they didn't know who the original owner was. And so here we have, again, we have to speculate as to what the cause was. And the most probable explanation is the original owner of the violin was probably very attached to it. It was probably a highly prized instrument. Maybe someone had had a career with it. And that person's energy had gone into this instrument. It may have gotten passed on after the original owner died, and maybe that energy then took a kind of a thought form, kind of personality. Maybe it didn't like being in a display case. Maybe this kind of spirit-like energy didn't like its new environment, didn't like her, didn't like being relegated to just being on display. There's any number of possibilities we can think of. But once it was removed from the house, then everything went back to normal.
It makes sense that objects that are owned by musicians, artists, maybe writers, these people in life tend to be very intense, dramatic sometimes, a little quirky, eccentric, and I would imagine, and you can disabuse me of this, Rosemary, but people who have that kind of life, who have that kind of personality in life, they would more likely make some sort of an imprint onto an object.
They certainly would, and anyone who has ever studied music and played an instrument would know the intensity that is focused when you are practicing and performing. My husband Joe is a classically trained pianist, and he had a stage career years and years ago, and you know, just hours and hours devoted to practice. You bond with your instrument. And it becomes like an extension of you. So it's very easy to see how these sorts of things could acquire a haunting presence.
Well, you know, here's something that's very strange as you're talking to me about this occurred to me. And last night I was hosting Coast to Coast, and I had Gary Patterson on the program, who writes about, you know, Tales from the Rock and Roll Graveyard. And, you know, he specializes in talking about musicians that have had such tragedy in their life and died untimely deaths. And we all know about the drug abuse and the alcoholism and mental illness, really, within the rock and roll world. And I'm wondering maybe whether some of that might be attributed to the actual instruments that these musicians are walking around with. Maybe they bought it secondhand and they have no idea. Is that possible, that that's why a lot of people in the music industry, live such tragic lives?
It's certainly an interesting theory, Richard, and has a lot of plausibility to it. Many musicians prize getting the instrument of somebody else, especially who is famous. And maybe the energies that come along with those instruments don't translate well to the new owner. It's not a good thing to do. So it could very likely be part of that mix.
Yeah, you think of all the artists, for example, that have died in plane crashes. A lot of musicians, you know, and now granted, the odds are that, you know, they're in a high-risk business. They're flying more than the average person. Sometimes they fly in bad weather. Their promoter says, no, you got to be in Louisiana tomorrow night, come hell or high water. You know, thinking about people like Jim Reeves, Jim Croce, Patsy Cline, Buddy Holly. You know, maybe it wasn't just the fact they were flying a lot. Maybe that guitar, they got it secondhand somewhere. Well, how do you know? Let's say you've got your house packed with old instruments, or you're running a music shop, or an antique shop. How do you know which piece is responsible? How do you go about finding that out?
The evidence is really, it's like it hides in plain sight. And in almost every case that we take on like this, the people, the victims will say that they had a funny feeling about something when they acquired it, but they chose to ignore it. They passed it off as their imagination, or maybe they didn't believe in the supernatural. There were so many other reasons why they absolutely had to have this object that they overrode their own gut intuition. An object that has troubling energy attached to it can be felt. It's palpable. When people look at it, handle it, they might get a queasy feeling, an uneasy feeling, or put off, and they don't pay attention to it. So that's one of the biggest giveaways right there. And one of the things that we advise people at the end of the book, where we talk about, you know, how do you recognize these things and what do you do about it, is that when you are out shopping, especially for secondhand things, pay attention to how your body is responding to an object when you look at it and handle it. Sometimes people get these, like, irresistible attractions to things for various reasons, and that seems to be part of it, too, where they're kind of lured in without realizing it. But it's still not a happy feeling. It's more of a fatal attraction kind of energy. And they'll almost always say to us, I knew there was something strange about that thing. Or when I picked it up, it felt really weird to me. And in the case of some people, especially young people who really like to go and look for weird things so that they can have unusual conversation pieces, That's exactly what they're looking for, and they don't realize that they're actually out looking for trouble.
I mentioned Scott McClelland earlier, who has this traveling sideshow up here called Carnival Diablo, and he's also a ripperologist, which is, for those not in the know, these are sort of, I hasten to use the word fans, or I'd rather not use the word fans, but that are enthusiasts of the whole Jack the Ripper case. And he's a collector. And one of Jack the Ripper's victims, I think she was the third victim of the serial killer, was Elizabeth Stride. She was known as Long Liz. She was a prostitute. She was particularly tall. And when she was found, in her hand were some coins, some English coins, money. And he owns, apparently, one of those coins. I don't know how this was verified, but he handed them to me, and he wanted me to look at them. And I tell you, I felt something strange. I don't know if it was because I made the association that these were once held by one of Jack the Ripper's victims, or whether there was some sort of an energy there. You got to be careful, you know, when people start passing this stuff around. How can you protect yourself?
The best thing to do if you're going to deal with a spirit world is to understand what's out there, to have a very good buffer around you. Now, everybody has a different threshold of sensitivity, and sometimes the victims in these cases are unusually sensitive to the spirit world. They sort of make ideal hosts, that they've got something in their energy field that spirits are able to latch onto and energize themselves from. Then other people have very good buffers around them. You could even bring a haunted object into their environment, and it would remain rather inert because it hasn't got anything to literally feed off of. So just as a common sense measure to understand your intuition, to know how it functions, I always recommend to people in all walks of life that a daily practice of meditation and prayer is like going to the psychic gym. It builds up that buffer around you. But paying attention to your gut instincts is really the number one thing that the average person should develop. We're all intuitive. We've all got that. And it can be our biggest ally in keeping the unwanted out of our home environments.
Very quickly, because we're almost out of time here, but, you know, vintage clothing are very popular now, or not even vintage clothing necessarily. People looking for deals on clothes will go to a thrift shop. Where, you know, if you know your labels, and, you know, you can really find some amazing articles of clothing, and sometimes the vendor doesn't know what he's got or she has, and you can end up buying a designer dress for $12 or something. People have to be on the lookout and be very careful and mindful of that, don't they?
Here again, the emotions of the original owner can linger in the clothing, and one of the best examples we have is a West Point dress cadet jacket that dated to about the turn of the 20th century. It was purchased by a young woman who wanted it for a fashion piece, and she loved it. She wore it all the time. She began having nightmares. They turned out to be scenes of fighting that we felt were World War I. And our conclusion was that whoever had owned that dress jacket, even though the jacket had not been used in combat, it still had a great deal of emotional significance to probably a young man who had it, that he had probably been killed in World War I because some of her nightmares were being in trenches and people being gassed, and you know, they used the chloroform gas.
Sure.
There.
Well, just goes to show you, you got to be careful.
Saw blood on herself, and all of it was held in the jacket, all of those memories.
All right, Rosemary, got to run. Wish we had more time. Congratulations on the new book, Haunted by the Things You Love, by Visionary Press.
Thank you very much, Richard. Good night.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.